comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are and wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Now, I got an email, speaking of you matter, I got an email from a listener who described a song that he heard on a particular show, and he really liked that song and wanted to know who is it and what's the name of the song. Now, I don't want to set a precedent here because I can't answer all of those. I get those frequently. The music, as we announce on the show, is from independent artists at musicalley.com. Okay? Write that down, musicalley.com. And this particular song is called Lucky Lola, and it's by Derek and the Darling. But please don't expect me to go through and announce all of the music that plays, okay? It's at musicalley.com. They are independent artists, and they are fantastic, and that is a fact. If you haven't subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, you really ought to do that. Our free weekly newsletter is called The K-Files. Now, if you go to my website, it amazes me, and this is not scolding, I'm just telling you, it amazes me. I get email from people who say, I looked all over your site and I couldn't find a link for K-Files. Well, it is the biggest link on the page, and it's right in the middle of the screen. Kind of hard to miss it. I also sometimes people say, I couldn't get your player to work and I missed the show. Did you try those alternative listen links? Read. There's good stuff there. All right. We know that the global warming scare was a complete fraud created with made-up data. We know that for sure. Once it was exposed, they changed the language from global warming to climate change. That's what they're all a buzz about now, is climate change. And they're still puffing out dire statements such as, sea levels are rising and we're all going to be doomed unless you pass this world tax. Somehow, if they take more money from us, the sea won't rise. Okay, amazingly, those two rather open scientific frauds are related to what my guest is going to discuss with us tonight, and that's kind of interesting because our guest is going to be discussing with us pole shift, something that lots and lots of people are afraid of. Especially as we're approaching 2012, there are a lot of people becoming very apprehensive about the possibility of pole shift. Well, he may be right, he may be wrong, but one thing he will be is right here when we come back from the break that is coming up. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest tonight is going to be Henry Kroll, researcher, writer, pilot, inventor. And as he started looking into pole shift, he found some interesting data related to climate change and related to global warming. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening has been with us before, and I'm delighted he's back with us this evening, Henry Kroll. Henry, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you for having me on. Call me Hank. Hank Kroll. Everybody calls me Hank, but anyway.
Okay, I'll call you Hank then. Hank is a researcher. He's a writer, a publisher, a pilot, an inventor. He digs rather deeply into a lot of subjects and comes up with some very interesting information. I will say, as I do with most of my guests, that it's controversial with some folks, and if it weren't, why would we talk about it? Things that are not controversial are not interesting to talk about. So, yes, it is in some quarters considered to be controversial. Some of the statements I made right at the beginning of the show are, with some folks, controversial. When I said global warming is a fraud, some folks cringed. When I said climate change is a fraud, some folks cringed. But in looking into this whole idea of pole shift, some of the data that Hank Kroll ran into had to do with data that blows away both the global warming crowd and the climate change crowd. But he was looking into information about pole shift. Hank, a lot of people that email this show, a lot of people that listen to this show, are very, very concerned about 2012 because they've heard all these dire predictions about how basically the Earth is going to come apart in 2012 and most of us are going to die. It's from reading what you sent me, I'm presuming, I guess, that that's not the position you take. Would that be correct?
Yes, I don't think that a lot of people are going to die unless it's by our own hands. This is pretty solid science, you see. I asked myself the question, how could a person prove that there was a pole shift in the past? And I was lying in bed, and I got to thinking about the Hawaiian Islands.
What made you think, Henry, Hank, what made you think about the Hawaiian Islands?
Well, I knew that they were formed by a volcano that stays virtually in one place on Earth at 19.5 degrees north of the equator. And this is sort of a vortex area, not just on Earth, but other planets. I knew there was a big spot on Jupiter that stays there, a permanent hurricane at 19.5 degrees north of the equator. And likewise on Mars, they have Olympus Mons, the biggest volcano in the solar system.
And it's at 19.5 degrees above the Martian equator.
It was before Mars's pole shifted at one time in the past. That's mm-hmm. what they tell us anyway.
Okay.
The mainstream scientists, NASA and the rest of them, you know. So we have these vortexes on Earth, somewhere around the Bermuda Triangle, there's one there, and then there's Hawaii. It's a permanent volcano that comes from deep within the Earth, and as the Earth's crust shifts over, it makes a new island, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, there's mainstream scientists thought that at one time that the Earth would flip over every so often, and the pole would shift on Earth, and I just wanted to prove whether that was a fact. Are we having phone problems here? You seem to be cutting in and out.
No, we're listening to you. You're doing just fine. I'm not cutting in at all. I'm just listening.
Well, I was just searching for a way to prove if there had been one in the past. You know, Albert Einstein and Charles Hapgood and Rand Flemeth, they were all for the theory that possibly the Earth's crust could slip over the liquid mantle core. See, the Earth's crust is sitting on a liquid of sorts. It's molten rock, and it might theoretically be possible that if it became unbalanced with lots of ice at the poles that were unbalanced, that the pole mantle could shift.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if it had in the past. So then I got to thinking about the age of the Hawaiian Islands and measuring how old they were. So I typed it into Google to find out how old Kauai was. And I'm getting a real good echo on this end, but anyway, it turns out that Kauai is 5,100,000 years old, whereas the big island of Hawaii to the southeast was recently formed, and it's only 400,000 years old. In between, you've got Oahu and Molokai and Maui, and they're all younger than Kauai. And Kauai is all part of, this Hawaiian island chain is all part of one archipelago that extends all the way over to Midway and Kurari, I guess. It's 1,000 miles, over 1,000 miles long. And as the Earth's crust shifts very slowly, a new island comes up, a new Hawaiian island appears out of the bottom of the ocean. So what I did to see if it happened recently, if there was a major crustal displacement, they call it a crustal displacement or a crustal slip, is I just measured the distance between Kauai and Maui. And just a few minutes ago, I did it again using Google Earth to get more accurate figures, and it comes out to about 310 miles between the center of Kauai to the center of the big island of Hawaii. And what you do is you multiply that by the number of feet in the mile to find out how many feet are between the two islands. It comes out to about 1,636,800 feet between the two volcanoes on the islands. And then you multiply that by 12, of course, to find out how many inches, and it's 19,641,600 inches. And then you divide that by the age difference between the two islands to find out how much the islands have moved per year. And the age difference is 4,700,000. You divide that into your 19,641,600, and it comes out to 4.179 inches per year. Somewhere around 4 to 5 inches a year, anyway. That's not exactly what I would call a crustal slip. It's just a normal expansion of the Earth's crust. Now,
okay, now how do we know that?
I tried to explain how the Earth grew in size. Apparently, it has expanded in the last 700 million years, almost doubled its size.
Okay, I've got a question now, Hank. How do we know that the Hawaiian Islands have been sitting in that same place now for all these millions of years?
That whole chain is more than 1,000 miles long, a couple thousand miles.
Mm-hmm.
And we see new islands being formed. And as the crust migrates to the northwest from the southeast, and it's due to the mid-ocean volcanoes. There's ridges in between Hawaii and South America and Mexico that spew up lava and expand the ocean basins, which actually cause the sea levels to fall and not rise.
Okay. So what's happening then is the floor of the ocean is spreading out.
Not just the Pacific, but also the Atlantic is getting wider by about 3 inches a year. I've read somewhere about that where they were able to measure it with radar or satellites.
Okay, but we're hearing from the climate change, oh my God, we're all going to die, let's pass a tax crowd. We're hearing from them that ocean levels are rising and that people are going to be inundated with these floods of waters.
Well, much of this is disinformation propaganda to make everybody scared so that we will give up our freedoms and keep us burning oil forever, carbon. Carbon merchants run the show.
Okay, so what you're telling us then is the sea levels are not rising but are falling.
Well, in some places they could be rising, but it would be to different continents rising up and down. Some of them, like the California coast, you've got a subduction zone where the ocean floor is going underneath the continental United States, so it probably won't settle there off California like all the doom and gloom people are saying that California may fall into the sea. But that doesn't mean you can have can't have a crack open up from the Gulf of or from Baja.
Mm-hmm.
All these in between, it's possible, but it's not probable.
Okay. Now, you in doing your research, you talk about a place where the IPCC, which is the United Nations Climate Fraud Commission.
Yeah, they met back quite a while ago in Switzerland, and they presented this data that the Earth temperature was rising 0.48 degrees. And also they were saying that the ocean levels are rising. But they used an island off the coast of Japan as their measurement for this data that they presented. And I did some research also on the climate warming shortly after and put a lot of material out there on the web myself on that same subject. And apparently there's a lot of volcanoes, and we were just recovering from a mini ice age of the 1700s. So how could we have global warming? I mean, you know, it's just a normal rise in temperature of half a degree and since the 1950s on and at the beginning of the industrial age. So anyway, there's been a number of volcanoes that each time one goes off, it cools down the Earth almost a half a degree. You have some major ones go off in the Philippines and then Mount Katmai up here in Alaska. And then last summer we saw a cooling of the Earth here in Alaska and other places from the volcano that went off last year in Iceland. It disrupted jet pilots or jet airplane flights going to Europe. And it just throws up so much ash into the atmosphere, it blocks sunlight and cools off the Earth a half a degree. So you can't really base climate change on a bunch of idiots over there that are basing it on a half a degree, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about this island? You started to tell us something. They use this island off of Japan as the place to take their measurements about the oceans rising.
I don't remember which island it was, but I read most of the IPCC material off the line, off the web there. I looked it up on the internet, and I could see where there were some flaws in it right away.
Okay, it's my understanding that they were using an island that's sinking.
Scientists have changed their mind about global warming. They signed a petition and sent it to Washington, but the people in Washington are still promoting what they call climate change. They worded the phrase differently. And it's all about forcing people to change their lifestyle, to live in a smaller house possibly, keep us burning carbon forever, restrict the number of children you can have, and also the size of car that you can drive. It seemed like they want to control every aspect of our lives, but they don't want to control their own lives or lower their own wages.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rather inflate the money supply by 50%. What I think is going on right now with the whole United States government is they're raising an army in case we have to go to war for World War III with the Chinese or somebody. We don't even know who, but they're doing it by putting all the businesses, driving them out of the country so that the children have no other opportunity than to join the armed forces. So I guess, you know, that's the best opportunity right now for our young folks in this country is to join the armed forces. This way they can maintain a huge army, and they don't care if they steal half of our lifestyle by printing more money or half of our livelihood.
Well, look, you know, I think that's probably, I think that's true. I don't think they do care. The value of our money since 2004 has dropped about 24%. That's precipitous, but that's true. And but back to this island. It's my understanding that they used an island for their measurements claiming that the oceans are rising, but they used an island that's actually sinking. Is that true?
That's what I read.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard this, and also that's apparently around 12,000 years ago, the sea levels rose abruptly, rather abruptly, about 300 feet. But it's so much variable data out there, you can't really get a handle on it, you see. And I think it could have raised up 300 feet at that time if something whacked into the earth and shed 200 kilometer thick coating of ice and melted the polar ice caps with heat.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
So do you think that happened?
In the cosmological ice ages, I used an online computer, and I think the moon created the Arctic Ocean because it fits about one-third the diameter of the moon itself. And I used an online computer called Arizona EDU/impact effects, and I put the mass of the moon in there, the mass of the Earth, and a speed of 2.5 kilometers per second and an angle of 11 degrees. And the resulting data that came back is that it would depress Earth's crust 5 kilometers, and that's exactly what the Arctic Ocean is in one place there. And it also said that the Earth's crust would bounce back up to about 1.3 kilometers, and that's what the average depth of the Arctic Ocean is at the present time, is 1.3 kilometers. So, you know, I thought that was rather synchronistic that all that sort of matched, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I have a lot of other supplemental data to back it up. So even Velikovsky's new book, his old book, I mean, that was never printed, titled In the Beginning, talks about a time when there was no moon, and about 12,000 years ago. And he was quoting the ancient Greeks, Ptolemy and Socrates and different guys that had read all of their ancient history at that time, trying to mm-hmm. figure out where mankind came from and where we started.
All right, I want to talk about a time when there was no moon, and I want to talk about this idea of the moon smashing into the Earth. But we're close enough to this next break that I don't want to get into that until we come back from break. But when we come back, I want to get into that because, you know, if the moon smashed into the Earth, that's the opposite of what a lot of the scientists say. They say that the moon is what's left after something else collided with the Earth, and that the moon actually used to be part of the Earth, and it's a big chip that broke off and then sort of recoagulated out there in space and became the moon.
Yeah, saying that happened millions or billions of years ago, you know, when the Earth was first formed.
Mm-hmm. So, but what you're describing is the opposite of that, and we'll get into that when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Henry, we're in a break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Hank Kroll, and we're talking about pole shift. Now, your research led you into the theory that the moon collided with the Earth, and that's the opposite of the one of the theories that's out there. One of the theories is that the moon used to be part of the Earth. And you got into researching and reading about a time before there was a moon. We've heard about this time before there was a moon. We've heard other people mention it. What? Tell us what you can about that. What do you know about the time before there was a moon? Who said that there was, and what did they say about it?
I did a lot of research for 3 years, about over a year I spent just looking for data on when the moon came in or when the first appeared in the sky. We looked at cave paintings to see if there was any ancient cave paintings of the moon. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you fine, Henry.
I'm getting a lot of static on this end, but anyway, we researched everything you can think of, and a lot of the moon rocks, all of the moon rocks they brought back don't match anything on Earth. They're either much lighter or they're made out of different material, and they're much older than the Earth. By a billion years, some of them are over a billion years older than the Earth rocks, the oldest rocks on Earth. And one of the rocks, they say, was 20 billion years old, which is older than any kind of Big Bang theory even, you know, mm-hmm. on the moon. So, and there's just a lot of weird anomalies. But this one book title is In the Beginning, which is the first three words of the Bible. It was written by Velikovsky, and I discovered it by accident after doing many web searches. It talks about the actual ancient Greek history of what they thought when the moon arrived.
Mm-hmm.
But people will believe, you know, I have a friend here who's really paranoid. He comes by the house, and he's really set in his own ideas of how things are, you see, and he's in his 70s. And, you know, people get set in their ways, and he'll believe things that are wrong even when you present the evidence and lay it out right in front of him. He doesn't want to look at it or doesn't want to agree with it. And on the sea levels rising, for example, I brought out these sheets that show the sea levels are actually falling 3 foot in this area every 100 years. And so, anyway, people are that way, I guess. They cannot look at the data and believe that because they've been taught otherwise their entire lives. The same thing with the moon chapter. You talk about it, and the people think I'm crazy, you know, because... Something did kill off all of the camels, tribes of people and horses and mastodons and everything in North America about 12,500 years ago. It just froze mastodons to death almost instantly with green food in their mouths and in their stomachs. And there isn't anything that could do that except a major hit from space that would suck away the atmosphere. And a small meteorite wouldn't do that. It would take an object about the size of the moon. And also, the Earth, I think, was tilted at that time. And this looks like evidence of planetary engineering, because once you've tilted it in relation to the sun's rays at 23.5 degrees, it doubles the amount of arable land available by thawing the ice caps back about 1,800 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some weird music in the background here. It's a bleed over from some other phone system, but
yeah, we're hearing your telephone's picking up some static from somewhere. I don't know where. It's not coming from here. So, but nevertheless, we can hear you. All right, now, and okay. Let me say, folks, Henry is in Alaska, and. I will tell you, Henry, that anytime we call from the lower 48 to Alaska, it's not infrequent that there are audio problems with it. I don't know why. Anyway, let's talk about this impact. Now, do you have any evidence that this impact, because the tilt of the Earth, I believe you said, took place, what, 12,000 to 12,500 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any, is there any evidence that it was caused by the impact of the moon? Could it have been something else the size of the moon?
There's a number of indicators that would indicate that. The Brooks Range, the Brooks Mountain Range in northern Alaska, matches the diameter, one-third the diameter of the moon. A lot of these mountain ranges are curved. They have a constant radius. Whenever you have a constant radius, you get, I mean, something hit the earth and threw up those mountain ranges. And mm-hmm. you can see that on Google Earth.
Okay. So the Brooks Mountain Range, also you mentioned the Arctic Ocean, and that the Arctic Ocean depth is what the scientists say would be the rebound depth after the impact of something the mass of the moon.
Right.
So where did the moon come from? If it did not used to be in our sky, where did it come from?
The moon could have been brought in, according to Velikovsky's book, In the Beginning and Earth and Upheavals. He had three books. It could have come in with Venus at that time. Venus may have been brought in with that time. People downgraded his theories on this, but he was actually basing it on ancient records. He was a student of calendars, and he was a scientist, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when Velikovsky tells us about a time before there was a moon, he is referring to ancient texts that he read. Some of the Greeks you mentioned, I believe you said Socrates, and some of the others. But look, they were referring to what were ancient texts in their time. So do they tell us anything about who was alive and what was the earth like before there was a moon?
Well, the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, talked about a race of people that lived in the mountains and ate acorns prior to that time. But that's about all there is on the subject, although other cultures have data on calendars that date back 75,000 years, possibly the Nordic races, possibly built cities. There's 20 cities in Russia on the plains of Arkham that were built 50,000 or 75,000 years ago.
20 cities.
And they're complete cities, walled cities, with roofs over the top. You see, they're like they're excavating them right now in Russia in the plains of Arkham. But anyway, I'm having a little problem with the doom and gloom people. They come here and they ask me these questions and they want me to straighten it all out for them, but I can't guarantee there's not going to be a solar flare that could disrupt satellite and internet communication. And I can't I don't know enough about the sun. There could be a magnetic pole shift. People don't seem to know the difference between the magnetic pole and the actual rotational pole of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently before the moon was brought in, the actual rotational pole was off the southern tip of Greenland, because Greenland is still covered with ancient ice. It dates back 300,000 years, you see. And it's a thick coating of ice on Greenland, and that's where the pole was. And the ice caps actually extended down as far as Kansas, and they carved out the Great Lakes. And by tilting the earth, all of a sudden, like, and within 20 minutes, 15 minutes, it caused a tremendous flood, and the Grand Canyon was formed, and it ice caps receded back because the sun's rays now hit the earth at a direct angle further north and further south of the equator as we orbit around the sun. And this doubled the amount of arable land available and opened up a lot of country for mineral exploration for whoever did this project. I think they were probably could have been done by some ETs or something that had control of the moon and knew how to do this, because you couldn't do something like that by accident. It's the laws of probability of bouncing it off the earth without killing off the entire planet like that, or beyond any kind of probable happenstance. So it had to be engineered. That's the way I see it.
But it did kill off a great deal of the animal and plant life on the planet, right?
Yes, it did. It wiped out North America and most all of Central America, too. But this major civilizations at the time were over in India and Egypt, so it didn't affect them that much, although they had tremendous floods. And every culture has a story of Noah on Earth, you know, where, and the Bible speaks of unleashing the wellsprings of the deep. And so by putting pressure on the earth, it caused massive volcanism and also water to squirt up from the deep, not from the clouds. Of course, it probably would rain 40 days and 40 nights also, but, you know, that's just another one of the effects.
All right.
Massive mountain building at that time. And I believe these volcanoes across near where I live also came up at that time. They seem to date at that time, about 12,500 years ago. And there would have been at least 500 years where living on Earth would have been very, very difficult because there was a lack of food. And be a lot of rain and cold, and it would be hard before it warmed up. But you see, the moon actually warms Earth and also causes more volcanoes to go off, which releases more carbon dioxide, which produces more carbon plant food in the oceans. The carbon CO2 in the oceans is what releases our free oxygen that we breathe. And it produced more plant growth by having sunlight hit the earth more directly and increase the amount of free oxygen available to us, thus extending the life of the planet. So by one whack, they opened up a whole bunch of herds of animals, could migrate north and south, and also increased areas where they could mine for gold. And because most of the earth was covered with ice prior to that time, we were in the ice age. And we're basically still in the ice age because the average temperature on earth is 32 degrees right now.
And is that right? I was not aware of the fact that the Earth's average temperature was 32.
It is 32 right now. And people just don't realize it because you've got freezing way below temperatures at the South Pole. The average height's above sea level is 7,500 feet down there. That's why it's so cold. But anyway, all past geologic ages, for 750 million years, the average temperature was between 60 and 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And then just the last 2.75 million years, it dropped down to 32 degrees, and it stayed there. And this was because we got kicked out of our nice, comfortable orbit around the Sirius system.
Oh, now see, now that's something we're going to have to talk about. We'll do that when we come back from this break. All right, folks, more with Hank Kroll right after this. Pardon me. Welcome back. As I suffer through weather changes and sinus attacks, my guest this evening is Hank Kroll. Hank, whenever we went away for break, and before I almost died from this sinus attack, you made mention of a time when the Earth was in orbit around Sirius. Tell us about that.
Well, it's the only possible way we could have gotten life started on the planet, you know, because Earth had a very thick atmosphere. Well, to begin, to start with, I had to plot our course to find out where our solar system was born. I don't think anybody ever did that before, but I drew a line on a constellation chart from the point that we are heading toward, extending it through the middle, and it winds up in Orion, and Orion is a birthing place for stars, and it just happens to be the nearest birthing place of stars to our sun, and since we're leaving the area, basic logic tells us we possibly were born there. And Orion is around 1,200, 1,300 light years distant from us. The stars that we see in Orion's belt, Betelgeuse over there, is 427 light years from us. And that is a giant red star, by the way. That one could kill us off any moment, too. In fact, it more already may have exploded because it's a very massive giant red star of about 7.5 solar masses, and it could shrink down into a white dwarf any time. We may have already done so, and we already may be dead. We don't even know about it yet. Anyway, we drifted out of Orion, and we got between Procyon and Sirius, and both of those giant stars are twice the size of our sun. And both of them have white dwarfs that orbit around them. Sirius B is 1.5 solar masses. So it has more gravity and mass than our entire solar system, and orbits Sirius A every 54 years at 8 to 12 AU. AU is an Earth distance. Mm-hmm. So it's fairly close to Sirius, and it probably feeds off of it. And that could explode into a neutron star, killing us also. And it's 8.5 light years away, so it would only be 8 years before we died if it blew right now.
But, all right, if they've got all that gravity, Hank, if they've got all that tremendous gravity, more than our entire solar system, and we were somehow in their gravitational pull, how did we get kicked out into where we are now?
Well, and what happened, it sucked us into orbit around Sirius A, and we were following Sirius B. So we had multiple suns in the sky, and the temperature went from 200 below zero on Earth. We were in an ice age prior to that time for 1 billion years, known as the Huronian glaciation. That's a long time to have an ice age, a billion years. But anyway, we got captured by Sirius, and the light and heat from those two stars took us out of that billion-year ice age, and we had a very thick atmosphere on this little planet called Earth. It was half as big as it is today. It was around 750 pounds per square inch, mostly carbon dioxide. There's no way that light from the sun could get through that atmosphere. You'd never see the sun with such a thick atmosphere. And so the only way you could get life stars, you had to be near something that put out 100 times more light than our sun. And Sirius B just does just that. It puts out more than 100 times the ultraviolet light of our sun, and you can't see it. It's in the invisible ultraviolet, but plants can see it. Plants use this light to produce starches and sugars and photosynthesis. And this is what helped take our atmosphere down and gave us our carbon resources. But for the next next 700 million years, we didn't have ice caps on Earth at all. The average temperature went up between 60 and 80 degrees. I could mail you a temperature graph that was produced in a Time Life book that shows this temperature on Earth. We didn't get ice caps on the Earth until about 2.75 million years ago. And so I looked around us to find out what could possibly kick us out of orbit, out of the orbit around Sirius system, for a stellar explosion that could blast us out of there to where we start making elliptical orbits around Sirius. And the only thing I could come up with is Barnard's Loop explosion over in Orion. It left a debris cloud about 13 degrees wide in the sky over there, and it sent two solar mass stars out into a triangle formation at 200 kilometers a second. I mean, that was a blast.
Mm-hmm.
And it possibly could have been a lot closer to us at the time, maybe 100 light years away or thereabouts. And so it could have dislodged us and turned. We could have lost our tractor beam around Sirius and gone into elliptical orbits. And the first ice ages were only like 5,000 years or so, where we had ice caps on the Earth. And then they steadily grew worse and worse to where now we have ice caps on the Earth for 90,000 years. And it's about 105,000-year cycle orbit around Sirius by our calculations. What we did is we used the mass gravities of these systems and total it up and use the galaxy gravity behind there to compute our orbit period of 105,000 years. And we put the math in the book. I have a co-author help me with the math, and we put the math in there, so I think anybody can do it. It's just using proportions. It's not difficult. I've taken this to two astronomers. I lay it out for them. They don't like the idea, but they got to do the math, and I make them do it, and then they start nodding their heads and agreeing with me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't print this stuff or can't write about it because they'd get laughed out of their job, you know.
Well, I know. I've made this statement before, so this is not something new for our audience. The sort of situation we're living in right now in our society with science and so forth is pretty much like the movie Planet of the Apes. There's a whole hidden history that the official apes don't want us to know about, and they do everything they can to keep us from learning about it. But that doesn't change the facts. All right, now. You say that we haven't had ice caps except for about, I think you said, the last 2 million years. Is that right?
2.75 million years we started to get ice caps for the first time. And you know, the only other ice cap we had was way, way back there a billion years ago called the Huronian Glaciation. But the temperature graph shows that the temperature is way up there for 750 million years.
Mm-hmm.
Just recently, yesterday, 2.75 million years ago in the history of the Earth, that we got ice caps.
Okay, so that's 2.7 million years, 2.75 million, not billion.
No, million.
Mm-hmm.
The ice caps are about that old on Antarctica. They can drill down through Antarctic ice, and that's where I got a lot of my data. It shows the drop in CO2 at regular intervals, which means we're in orbit around something. It shows a rise in temperature, and those intervals are 105,000 years, which correlate with our mass in our orbit periods around the Sirius system. So whether you want to agree with me or not, that's all right. Just look at the data and decide for yourself. You know, I don't care. I'm just putting it out there,
mm-hmm.
hoping that some graduate students will take it and run with it and maybe get us out of this haze that our entire science seems to be in, you know.
Well, little by little, they are in a haze. Little by little, the scientific community is sort of beginning to wake up a little bit. Some of them are waking up to the fact that there are no laws of physics. What we call laws of physics are just descriptions of our current understanding, and current understanding is subject to change. Everyone thought that Newtonian physics was it. It was the way to go until this little guy named Einstein came along and proved that it was wrong. And, you know, you give credit where credit's due. Newton did a great job, but Einstein improved on it. And someone else, like Einstein, will come along and will step right over some of those so-called laws of physics. And someday out in the future, there'll be a talk show host talking to a researcher and writer, and they'll chuckle about way back in 2010 when people used to believe these so-called laws of physics. They'll chuckle about it, and just like we chuckle about ancient science sometimes. So, you know, some of the scientists are beginning to wake up to that fact, but we need more of them to wake up to it, and we need them to wake up to it quicker. We have to take a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Thank you. and welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are just now joining us in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. Delighted you're here. My guest this evening, Henry Kroll. He is a researcher, he is a writer, a publisher, an inventor, a pilot, and we're having a very interesting conversation with Hank about the Earth, where it came from, and what's happened to it. And we're going to connect this up to Pole Shift here in just a moment. Let me say this, that because of weird stuff with the telephones, and I'll tell you what it is, we have Hank on the telephone line that we normally use to allow you to call in and ask questions or make comments. The line that we normally use for our guests will call everywhere else, but when we try to call Hank Kroll with it, all we get is a busy signal. But I can use this other phone line and get right through to him. So I don't know what's going on with that, but that's what's going on. And so Hank, let me go back and recap something here. Our orbit, and I suppose that includes our whole solar system, is in orbit around Sirius, right?
It still is. It's just it's an extreme elliptical orbit right now. Mm-hmm. We go out to about 9 light years and practically stop, and we can't tell we're in orbit around anything because they're not moving. But right now we're heading towards Sirius. It's 7.5 kilometers per second, and we're at 8.5 light years.
Okay. So what happens when we re-enter the Sirius system? What kind of climate change can we expect then?
Well, we lose all the ice caps on Earth, and all life forms on the surface over the next few thousand years have their DNA modified by the incoming ultraviolet light and cosmic rays from the Sirius system. Everything looks different on the other side. So everything and humans may have to go underground for a period of time in order to retain our shape, either that or we grow scales or something, I don't know what. But the creatures in the deep ocean don't change because they're shielded by the water. So you've got sharks and whales and different things that remain the same basically for millions of years.
Okay, so when we make the loop and we come back this direction, life forms on the Earth are going to look quite different than they do today. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but we're looking at around 14,000 years before we get there. It just takes a long time. The whole orbit period is 105,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Things move very slowly in space, and humans live such a short period of time that we can't even comprehend 100,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we look at the data and try to get a grasp of it and put it together to where the human mind can wrap around it. It's really hard, you know, it's really difficult. I worked 7 years on this book. And then when I couldn't find a publisher, I had Trafford publish it for me. They're a Canadian company, Trafford Publishing, and they delayed me. There was a lady there. I think she's religiously biased, believes the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. I couldn't get the book published for 2 years. It took over 2 years. They had to fire her before I could get it published.
Wow. Wow.
So anyway, I'd like to complain about my publisher because recently, according to a New York Times article, or a Wall Street Journal, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. It's a Wall Street Journal article reported that Author Solutions bought out iUniverse, which is a on-demand publisher, and so is Ex Libris. They bought them out. And then they acquired Trafford Publishing in January 2009, and I haven't received a check from them since that time.
Pardon my laughing, but you know,
they are a Canadian company, and their offices have moved to Illinois, what is their address here? But anyway, they moved to the estates there, and I've been trying to get them to update my website so I can find out how many books are sold, and they don't even tell you. But people are able to buy the books, okay? They order them through Trafford or Amazon or Barnes and Noble or anywhere, but I don't get paid, so I'm doing this for free.
Mm.
And you can order 30 books. I've got 30 on hand, and I can order more if you give my address out on the air.
Yeah, go ahead. You can give your address out now.
And this is Henry Kroll. That's K-R-O-L-L, and my address is 513 Peninsula Avenue, 513 Peninsula, Kenai, Alaska. Now, Kenai is spelled K-E-N-A-I, and Alaska is abbreviated A-K. And the zip code up here is 99611.
So if they buy them from you, that's the only way you can get paid, is if they buy them from you.
Well, it's the only way I can get paid. But also, if you have received a book from them since last January, send me a Christmas card or a postcard. Let me know how you like it and, you know, whatever. And I appreciate it. And then I can use that to show that I have, have been selling books, and I can hire a lawyer to come back at him or something. But it's a big company that took over all the subsidy publishers in America, practically. They've got Author House, iUniverse, and Ex Libris, and also Trafford Publishing. And Author Solution is the one that bought them out.
Well, if they move to Illinois, I got a plan for you here. You ready for this? There's this guy. You might have heard of him. He's fairly well known, and you may have heard of him. His name is Barack Obama. Now, Barack was a senator from Illinois. So it's just possible that if you were to write a letter to Barack Obama, I think the address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C. I believe that's it. So if you write a letter to Barack Obama, maybe he can pull some strings here or there in Illinois, where he used to be a senator, and get him to cut your check.
Well, I kind of doubt that. He's kind of a busy man, you know. He's not going to mess with me, but you can get them. I can tell you the State Department would be interested in something that they bought contracts or assets that were Canadian from a Canadian company and transferred it to the United States. And there are certain obligations about paying the authors of those books that they bought from the rights to print from Canada that the State Department would be interested in, I think.
Yeah, they probably would. All right, now I want to go back to the orbit around Sirius. Now, you say this is about a 105,000-year orbit. And then you were telling us about some ice cores that were drilled. Tell us again where they discovered that there was a shift in climate every 105,000 years. Where was that? And give us the details of that again.
Well, you can see all that for yourself. You just simply go on Google and type in Antarctic ice core graphs. And you'll see massive information where it shows temperature changes back almost 3 million years, about 2.5 million years, and methane and dust deposits, snowfall, and carbon dioxide. That's one of the clues that we were in orbit around something that imparts more ultraviolet light, was the fact that carbon dioxide practically disappears at regular 105,000-year intervals.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is increased UV light striking Earth causes the plants to grow in the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And it mops up the carbon dioxide with plant growth. And the sun doesn't do that. It can't change its spectrum into the UV. So obviously has to be another influence, another input of light from someplace.
Okay, so as we traveling now, I believe you said at 7 kilometers per second towards Sirius, as we are approaching Sirius, although I understand the distance is very, very great, and so it's going to take about another 14,000 years for us to get there. I understand that. However, there has to be incrementally an increase in the ultraviolet light coming from Sirius, wouldn't there?
Of course, yes. In fact, because the gravitational force is so strong, we're going to pick up speed. By the time we reach even with Sirius, we should be traveling around 200 kilometers per second, close to it anyway, because we're going to come within less than a tenth of a light year, and we can compute the amount of light going to increase to Earth at a tenth of a light year because we know the output of Sirius. Sirius B puts out 100 times more light than our sun, and at one-tenth light year, that effectively doubles incoming UV light.
What's that going to do to you and me?
This increases the planet growth, you see.
Yeah, but what's it going to do to you and me, to humans?
Well, we have several thousand years to evolve differently, or we can remain down here on this planet being stupid and burning carbon and destroying our own air and using up our oxygen, burning things, or we can get out there and we can try to spread life around on other planet bodies and develop our technology where we can live in hostile environments like Mars and Venus and possibly even a really colder outer planets. You know, we don't know. We might have to migrate out to Saturn, the moons of Saturn. In fact, I think the moons of Saturn were inhabited at one time. You got this one moon there with a ridge 60 miles high that divides it perfectly around the equator, Enceladus. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I believe it's, Iapetus?
And they found these stones, hundreds of them, with the exact same models with the same holes, craters, and everything in a South African mine. They're a mile down under the ground. It looked just like that moon, and they don't know what they're made of hematite, some form of iron.
Mm-hmm.
And they're billions of years old. So maybe there was intelligent life on this planet a billion or so years ago, you know, that made those models and it inhabited several planets in this solar system at that time. You see, we don't know. It's just, and they probably weren't human-like, or maybe they were. You know, we don't know that either.
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that there was some intelligent civilization here on this planet millions of years ago. There's a lot of evidence, like those little orbs that you're talking about. But there are a lot of other things that have been found that are millions of years ago. And back when it is said, we weren't here. You know, they have fossilized, they have in a museum somewhere, I forget where it is now, but it's a fossilized footprint. Now, it's not a footprint, it's a boot print. It actually shows the heel and everything. And this thing is like 300 million years old. So it's, you know.
Yes, I've seen that.
Yeah. So, I think there's evidence that it's pretty clear that a long, long time ago there were intelligent civilizations here, and they were doing some manufacturing that was pretty incredible. And, you know, for whatever reason, they're not here now. All right.
Well,
now,
even our history is.
Yeah, go ahead.
Messed up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our history is messed up. And that's why I said it's sort of like the movie Planet of the Apes, where the head apes don't want all the other apes to know the truth about the past. And
someone took millions of pounds of copper out of the Michigan and shipped it through the Illinois waterway over to Europe at a time when we were in the Bronze Age, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I want to get back to pole shift, because as you were doing all of this research, you came to the conclusion that we really don't have to worry about a 2012 pole shift. Now, we talked about this briefly earlier, but I want to focus on that. And again, I want to focus on that because we have so many people that write in and are very fearful about 2012 and very fearful that there's going to be a pole shift. And you're saying that the evidence scientifically doesn't support that happening. describe for us in a nutshell what it would take for the earth to flip over, for the crust to slip, or any of those things. What would it take?
There's only one object up there in the sky with enough mass to impact Earth, to tilt it, and that's the moon. And the Earth has a certain mass, and it's E24 kilograms. It's 8 point something, E20. Just punch in Google, mass of Earth, and it'll pop right up in front of you. And to move that mass requires a certain amount of force, and you can compute that mathematically. I mean, it's not too difficult. You can go online and use an impact computer if you want. But anyway, to physically tilt the Earth or to cause the pole to shift would take a large body equal the size of the Earth orbiting very close to it, or maybe larger. And that's not likely to happen. I don't see any evidence of Nibiru. There could be a red dwarf star hitting away, but to get here in 1 year, it'd have to be traveling awful fast. And then to orbit between us and the sun, I don't see that happening. I've looked at a lot of the videos and stuff on YouTube, and there's no real evidence that I can find of Nibiru, unless it's really hid by the mainstream somewhere. I don't know. You see pictures of things that people think might be that rogue planet or rogue star, red dwarf, its orbits our sun, but there's no actual proof of it. And then you got the magnetic pole shifting. Well, that can happen because the sun changes its magnetic field every so often. You could possibly reverse the magnetic pole of the Earth. But right now, the magnetic pole is up there in northern Canada, and it's migrating toward the true North Pole very slowly, and it's been traveling up that way for 1,000 years or more, and it was down near the southern tip of Greenland and at the old rotational pole when the moon hit, and it's just now catching up with the true rotational pole of the Earth. The magnetic pole is migrating up there, and 50 kilometers a year, it's increased its rate of travel.
Okay, so unless we had something like a Nibiru that came by, and let me get this straight. Now, let's say for a moment that Nibiru does make its appearance and that it does come by. Are you saying then that it would perhaps or could perhaps cause the moon to smack the Earth again, and that could cause a pole shift? Is that... what would Nibiru be doing to us to cause a pole shift?
I don't think it could do that. It could actually bounce off our moon, maybe, if it came within that distance. But none of this is likely to happen. And, you know, we don't even see any evidence of Nibiru, let alone anything happening within the next year. So yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about any of that stuff. You know, the biggest threats to our existence are stellar explosions like Cirrus B. It's right at the Chandrankar limit where it could go into a white dwarf, a neutron star, or you got Bethelgeuse sitting over there. But, you know, other stuff like Nibiru or magnetic pole shifts, or, you know, might incinerate some of the Earth with solar flares if they were bad enough, and we are losing our magnetic field on this planet a little bit, having the Earth's magnetic field migrate toward the North Pole. It seems to be weakening. It amounts to about one gauss at this latitude, or this latitude where I'm at, and at the equator, the magnetic pole is two gauss. So, anyway, the Earth's mass is 5.98 E24 kilograms.
Mm-hmm.
And the moon mass is 7.35 E22 kilograms. But when we did the calculations, I added on some ice because we thought that the moon had ice on the side facing us because it's relatively smooth, and it would have dumped it off on Earth and raised sea levels 300 feet. My co-author thought there was a lot more ice on the moon than I thought there was, but he thought there was over 200 kilometers on this side, and it was unbalanced, and it just sort of bumped, set us off on the Earth and could have dumped a lot of DNA onto us also. Who knows what sort of seeds or things are frozen in that ice, you know, codfish, whatever.
Do you think the moon, now you said there are some of the rocks from the moon were like 20 million years old. I mean, 20 billion years old.
Older than the Big Bang. I mean, you know, it goes back beyond the birth of the solar, or beyond the birth of the entire universe.
Well, and see, that our moon is another reason I don't buy the Big Bang theory. You know, nothing cannot explode into something. I mean, it's there had to have been a something somewhere. And
take on that that you may not have come across. One of the things that I came across is these Type 5 civilizations. This is on the India Daily scientific program over there in India. They think these Type 5 civilizations developed to the point where they can create matter, they can create big bangs, and then accelerate away at the speed of light, near the speed of light. So I put in the book that if God really did create the universe with everything in it, he would have to get up there in some sort of spaceship approaching the speed of light, and he could actually do it in 7 days, 6 days, you know, because time moves very slow when you're traveling near the speed of light, and it would take 1 day would equal a billion years or more, 2 billion years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it could be. But, you know, the fact that there is darkness in space proves there is a speed faster than light, because when you're moving at or below the speed of light, you see light. And when you exceed the speed of light, you have now stepped into the speed of dark. And so space...
Right. Yeah, one of the things we come up with is that we thought that all that dark matter out there might just be photons. That, how long does light travel? You know, how many billion years does those little particles travel before they lose their energy? But we just don't know, you know. There's also a possibility there's more than one creation event, because the stars in our around us, the stars in our local group, the majority of them are ancient red dwarfs. They're much older than our sun. And right in our own group of 100 stars, over half of them are red dwarfs. That we live in this cluster that we live in, they're very, very old. They're billions of years older than our sun, and some of them could have been swapped in from various galactic collisions, because our galaxy has eaten up at least 10 major galaxies and about 100,000 or more star clusters that come from just remnants out there in the middle of space that eat them up, you know, and they eat up the DNA of space, all the elements.
All right, we're going to have to step away, and we'll be back right after this break. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Hank Kroll. Well, we were talking with Hank Kroll. That's something. Don't know what happened to him. We'll see if we can get him back online. And interesting conversation, though, huh? We'll see. And it's ringing. Well, I don't know if you can hear that. You hear that? Now, that's what we were getting on the other line when we tried to call him. So I'll tell you what we'll do, folks. We will We'll open the phone line for you because we can't get Hank on the line. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's give it one more try and see what happens. Well, we're getting a ring. So we'll see what happens here. It's ringing. Hank, are you back with us?
Yeah, I'm back on.
Okay, I don't know what happened. But, you know, when I tried to call you back using this line, same line we were on before the break, I got that busy signal just like I did with the other phone line. So I don't know. There must be something with the phones between here and Alaska somehow. Okay, now, Hank, there's a theory, and I'm sure you've run across it because I know you research your stuff very well, but there's a theory out there that the moon is actually an ancient spaceship. And even NASA has stated that it's hollow. What do you know about that, and what do you think about it?
We did a lot of work on that. The Russians, for sure, are convinced it's a spaceship. It's just our guys over here, they don't believe it, you know. But it has a hollow bunch of water in the center of it. And actually, we think from the seismic work that they did on the moon, they dropped that booster rocket on there. They had seismographs. It works out where the crust is about 20 to 30 miles thick, and it rang like a bell for over an hour when that booster rocket hit. So it may have a metallic shell around the core. And if you were going through space for long periods of time, one of the things you'd want to bring with you is water. And water would pollute or get stale unless it were salt water. So it could have a salt water or sodium ocean in the moon. And the moon actually has a sodium atmosphere, and you don't hear anything about that. But it has been photographed by astronomers during solar maximum. The moon has a tail like a comet because of its thin atmosphere. It extends out about 60 kilometers or more from the moon's surface. It's very thin, of course, but it does have an atmosphere, and it's sodium. And then, of course, when the moon passes between us and the sun, we get a taste of that sodium, and it's very poisonous every month. And it could regulate certain things on Earth, that sodium influence on the way we think or feel. Maybe people that are on the edge or go a little more crazier than usual, or, you know, just the other cycles that are connected to the moon. What do you think?
I'll tell you what. I think that it's possible that the moon is an ancient spaceship. And then you got to wonder, when it hit the Earth, was that a student driver?
Well, it wasn't exactly rock hitting rock.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's what the computer program is based on that we use. But it's more like ice hitting ice, because there's probably ice up there where it bounced off the Earth, and there was ice on the moon at the same time. But the forces would have been about the same, I think, as far as depressing the Earth's crust. But anyway, yeah, I think it's a spaceship. They took magnetometer satellites around the moon that map out 1,000-mile-long iron anomalies, like iron girders.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a geodesic dome, a buckyball composition made out of 1,000-mile steel girders. It's the Death Star, you know, the Star Trek. Excuse me. And it's just very old, and a lot of dust and collected on the surface over the millennia.
Do you think it's possible that whoever drove that spaceship here might still be alive there?
There could be inhabitants on the moon. I think they use it to terraform planets like Earth, and it could have been used before or more than one time, where they would take Earth. You see, we were in an ice age 12,000 years ago, 12,800 years ago, where ice covered most of the Earth. And in order to extend the life of the planet and wake up the people that are down here and make them come alive to where they realize things are happening, you'd have to thaw the ice caps back so that there would be more room for larger populations to grow food and animals, and also increase the oxygen supply, because, well, we need a constant supply of oxygen on any planet because it'll disappear over time. Everything rots and rusts. You've got to have plants. You've got to have plankton in the oceans. And right now, we've cut down half the rainforest, and we've killed off half the plankton in the oceans is missing, and half the fish are gone. And we're burning up, you know, quite a bit of the oil. But so we haven't been very good stewards of this planet. And supposedly, according to our major religions, that we were given dominion over the planet, and we haven't really done a very good job of it.
Is it possible that whoever drove the moon here, assuming that the moon is a spaceship, whoever drove it over here, is it possible that we'll reach a point where they say, okay, that's it, that's a wrap, and they start up the engine and drive away?
Well, there are several ways to propel a moon, and I did get into that in the book. I worked hard on that, did a lot of thinking on how you would put a moon in orbit around the planet. And the only thing we can come up with is you had to bounce it off the surface just right at the right speed and the right angle to make it go back into orbit. And let's see, who was that? It was Darwin or somebody got interested in how close the moon was to Earth at one time. You see, it's receding from Earth at about, 3 centimeters a year. And he run it back in time to where he got within about 10 kilometers or 5 kilometers of Earth or something. He couldn't go back any further on the math for some reason. But anyway, yeah, I think it's probably been used to terraform more than one planet, and it's very old. And the space, the solar, the universe itself is extremely old, maybe endless in age, and there's been a series of big bangs or stellar explosions that create all the heavier elements. The amount of heavy elements on Earth is another indicator of the age of the universe. To make platinum group metals like rhodium and iridium and stuff, it takes a tremendous explosion to compress the atoms down to where they make the heavy elements. And they're only made in stellar explosions. So in order to have that much on the surface of the Earth, you have to wait billions and billions of years for these stars to evolve to the point where they will explode and turn into neutron stars and eject the heavy elements off, or you got to wait for the galaxies to explode themselves. We don't know exactly where all the heavy elements come from. Some may come from the galaxy, others from stellar explosions. We just haven't got a clue.
All right. But how did they propel the moon to start with? I understand that in order to get it in orbit, it has to be a certain mass at a certain speed and hit at a certain angle. But how did they propel it from wherever it came from? How did they propel it toward Earth?
Well, that is, a problem that only an advanced intelligence could come up with. I think that if you were smart enough, you'd wait for the right time and nudge things over some way or another where it would come by Earth as if it was in orbit around Venus already. When Venus came in, it could have, brought it into where it bounced off Earth. Either that, or it could have happened when Venus was at apogee and Earth was orbiting closer to the sun, and it could have been lost from Venus and then came in and bounced off Earth. But there's a number of ways of propelling a moon that we're not, don't have the technology or the advanced science to visualize it. Most everything warps space, and when you got rotating bodies like that, you could make them COSREF also had a way of move. They create a field through space, and if you had large weights inside propelled by gimbals or bearings of some kind, large heavy weights, or just the water that's in there, if you rotated the moon a certain way, then the water would propel it through space.
Hmm.
But we just don't have the brain power to do this. I'm lucky to do what I did. I mean, to put this whole book together was, I thought, the most hardest challenge I ever did. I had to pound my head on a table for 7 years. It took me 3 years to get the people to publish it because they're so religiously biased. And then, you know, just getting it out there was really, really difficult for me.
Yeah, I understand. All right, now there's a theory that the moon at one time was in orbit around Mars, and that it came here from Mars. Did you run into that information anywhere?
Well, I never came across that information. According to Velikovsky, it was the moon around Venus.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been used to terraform Venus or even possibly bring it into our solar system. Or it could have been a moon around anything, around Tiamat or whatever, but...
What do you see as... we've got a couple of minutes here till we get to our next break. What do you see coming up? What's the next big thing coming to Earth?
Well, NASA has an eyeball on the space. A lot of governments around the world keep their eyes up there looking. And I personally don't see any threat from space other than stellar explosions and possibly CMEs, solar coronal mass ejections and the weakening poles. The biggest threats to our existence on this planet probably are just exploding stars, or maybe the galaxy is going to explode. There's an extinction that occurs regularly every, what is it now? I had it in the tip of my brain a little while ago. It was 650 million years or something. The guy from the University of Chicago came up with his regular extinctions by cataloging all of the die-offs over millions of years. And the galaxies go into flare mode, apparently, and give off these layers of iridium every so often. And we look out through space with the Hubble and other telescopes. You can see some of the galaxies are flaring up. I don't remember what percentage it is. I haven't got any recent data on it, but I was looking at some material fairly recently on the flaring galaxies.
All right, we're going to step away for a break for just a moment, and we shall return, folks. And we'll be in final approach, and we'll be talking more with Henry Kroll about all of this, the coming times, and what we need to do. We'll be back right after this. Head on out of the show, and we're in final approach. Weird stuff happening with the equipment, I promise you. And I don't know why. Let me tell you something. Yesterday, the TV computer decided it could not get on the internet, but the radio station computer was broadcasting. Everything was fine. And then that all changed by this morning. The TV computer could get on the internet, and the radio computer could not. So I don't know what the deal is. And then the producer, of course, is sitting in the other room, and he's using a laptop, and it is wireless. And just before the show, the wireless stuff went down. Now, you might say, well, that's the router. The router's doing all that. But we changed routers. Same result with the new router. So I don't know. Weird stuff. And I apologize that we could not finish out the show with Henry with us. But very interesting. Very, very, very interesting. The situation seems to be, if I understood what Henry was saying, that the Earth, the actual tilt of the Earth, you know, it's tilted on its axis by 23.5 degrees. And he says that it was caused by an impact. He thinks it was the moon that impacted the Earth, coming in at 11 degrees and striking the Earth in the area that we know as the Arctic Ocean, and that it would have compressed the Earth's crust 5 kilometers, and that the bounce back would bring it back to a depression of 1.3 kilometers. And that is the depth of the Arctic Ocean, he says. It's also pretty curious about the 105,000-year orbit that our entire solar system is making around Sirius. Because there's a 105,000-year cycle that they've detected in the ice cores from Antarctica, where every 105,000 years you have a change in the CO2, a change in the climate. And he was talking about the CO2 goes almost entirely, it vanishes. And this would indicate that we were somewhere where we were getting pretty extreme amounts of ultraviolet light. And his theory is that it's because we are orbiting Sirius. And as we come back around near Sirius, we're getting the intense ultraviolet light from that system. So I find all of that very, very interesting. He doesn't see a change, big change coming in these cycles. And he says we're still about 14,000 years away from arriving in the Sirius system. So we don't have to worry about any of that stuff happening to us for the next 14,000 years. A lot of folks are very, very, very concerned about 2012. I think you know I'm not. I think 2012, the significance of 2012 is that it happens between 2011 and 2013. I don't see any other significance to it. Now, there are people that write to me and they get upset with me and they tell me, you know, that I just obviously do not understand. And look, you may be right. The fact is, if I'm wrong, whatever happens will happen to me too. I just don't, honestly, I don't see evidence, real evidence, that indicates that it's all over in 2012. I do not see that. And I think, you know, the big date is December the 21st, 2012. That's when they say it's all going to end. But I think on December the 22nd, I don't know what date that is. I mean, what day of the week? But on let's say it's on a Monday through Friday, we'll be broadcasting. I'll tell you this: the next show after December the 21st, the next day for a show, we'll be broadcasting. I fully believe that. And can I prove it? No, but I will on December the 22nd, 2012. I think what's going to happen on December the 21st, 2012, is another day like every other day. And I think that what's going to happen on December the 22nd is I'm going Christmas shopping to get all my last-minute Christmas shopping done. But like I said, if I'm wrong, if it all is going to come crashing in on December the 21st, 2012, if that's what's going to happen, it'll happen to me too. We'll all find out about it together. Now, you can do what you want to do. I'm not opposed to being prepared, as much as it's possible. I'm not opposed to having stocks of food and water and, you know, matches and flashlights and solar panels. And, you know, if you can have all that stuff, I think you should. You should be ready for a calamity of any kind at any time, if you can be. And as much as you can be. But my preparedness for calamity has nothing to do with whether I think it's all coming to an end on December the 21st, 2012. Because I don't. I really don't. And I hope that hearing from someone like Henry Kroll helps you to not be so fearful. It is a joyous time of the year, the Christmas season and the Hanukkah season. It's a joyous time of the year when people ought to be lighthearted and glad to be alive. And in 2012, at this point in 2012, there will be people absolutely scared to death, terrified, because the date today is December the 6th on this side of the planet, and there are people who think it's all going to be over on the 21st. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be all right. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.